One. Hi and welcome into Meet Me the Movies. I am Thomas Manning, joined as always by Noel T. Manning II. We have a very special show today. We're joined by filmmaker, writer, and co-founder of the Slam Dance Film Festival, Mr. Dan Mirvish. Dan is the director of the political comedy and thriller 18 and a half, which takes a look at the Watergate scandal and the missing 18 and a half minutes on the Nixon White House tapes. So Dan, thanks so much for your time today.
No, thank you guys. It's great to be honored to meet both all the Mannings. Yeah.
I know you're seeing double a little bit here, but we're very happy to be here and talking about 18 and a half ahead of its DVD release. And before we really dive into talking about the film, I'd love to have you reflect back to some of your earlier memories of learning generally about Watergate and Nixon and that entire ordeal. How far back does that go for you?
Right. I think my earliest memories, I do actually remember, I think in kindergarten, campaigning for McGovern. So that would have been the 72 election. And then I do remember we were on a big family trip out east the summer that Nixon resigned. So I was in upstate New York at the time, and I remember watching that with my sister. So that was a big, you know, even at a for an 8-year old, that made a big impression. You don't just have the president resigning too often. But I do vaguely remember sort of all of Watergate that led up to that, not all of it, but how it was always on TV. I think my wife was reminding me, and she's even a little younger than me, that it interrupted Sesame Street. You know, it was that big, the Senate Watergate hearings. And, you know, and then working with Bruce Campbell, who's a couple of years older than me, he remembered, you know, he didn't play baseball outside for a whole summer because he was inside watching the Watergate hearings. It was, you know, we were just talking about the O.J. Simpson chase. It was our O.J., you know, in a sense. And so it made an impression. Didn't matter how old you were, it was in the zeitgeist. Everyone was talking about it because that was, you know, and there were only, you know, three or four networks then. So if it was on TV, that's what you had to watch. You know, that was it.
Yeah, I was just telling Thomas before we went on the air that our former general manager for Meet Me at the Movies and for C19 TV, Greg Tillman, he said he remembers finally, and he was a news junkie even as a young kid. And he said he was excited to be able to go home after school every day and watch Watergate while his friends were upset because they were missing Sesame Street or missing cartoons or reruns of Gilligan's Island. But Greg, he said he just loved it. He was just like, this is fascinating. This is history unfolding before our eyes. And you nailed it when you were talking about networks. There was ABC, mm-hmm. CBS, NBC, and then you had PBS. And that was it, unless you had you know, local stations that would do something just locally, like a government or an educational channel. But that was it. That was it.
Yeah, it was really an all-consuming story. And, you know, and because of it, it's kind of funny because, Nixon had plenty of other scandals leading up to Watergate, which we touch on a little bit in the film, but nobody remembers them, you know, dealing with ITT and milk subsidies and all kinds of things that were, you know, would have been his big scandals and, you know, getting rid of Agnew, his first VP, you know, for a bribery scandal, you know, little things like that. But Watergate is the one that we remember for sure.
Yeah. And for me, I was telling Thomas as well, my first memories relating to that, I do remember hearing about those Watergate scandals as a kid. I do remember watching him resign and that last day in office where he, you know, walked up the airplane, waved to everyone. I remember that just vividly and how unusual that was. And for me, of course, it was unusual, but I just remember everybody gathered around the TV because this was history. And I remember Gerald Ford when he basically chose Gerald Ford to replace Agnew, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. And I grew up in Omaha, so our connection was that Gerald Ford was born in Omaha. So everyone in Omaha is like, "Woo, we got a local guy as president. Go Gerald Ford!" You know, So that, you know, that was when you're young, that makes a big difference.
And so looking to the inception of the script for 18 and a half, I know you and Daniel Moya worked together on mm-hmm. it. When did that begin? What ignited and led to the development of this screenplay?
Sure. So it really sparked the day after the 2016 presidential election, which just happened to coincide with the last day of shooting on my prior film, Bernard and Huey. Well, that was the name of the last film. And so I was going to show dailies from that film to our screenwriter, Jules Pfeiffer, who some of you may know was an Oscar Pulitzer Prize winning cartoonist for The Village Voice and screenwriter for Carnal Knowledge. But he'd written our script, Bernard and Huey. So I went out to see him, and we had been shooting those last couple days in New York City. And I drove out to Shelter Island near the Hamptons on the tip of Long Island to see Jules and show him this footage. But meanwhile, we were, of course, talking about the election and the election of Donald Trump. And Pfeiffer had won his Pulitzer Prize largely for his political cartoons about Nixon and about Watergate in the early 70s. And so inevitably, the conversation turns to comparisons between Trump and Nixon, and how bad could it possibly get? You know, we survived Nixon, we survived Watergate. What could, you know, how many impeachments could we possibly have in the next 4 years? And anyway, so we kind of had Watergate on the mind. And then my friend Terry, who had been an indie film producer in LA, but for the last few years, he'd inherited his grandparents' motel pretty close to where Pfeiffer lives, in a town called Greenport. And so we took the ferry from Shelter Island back to stay with at Terry's motel. And this motel was built in the 50s and 60s and was kind of, they stopped preserving it or stopped renovating it in around 1974. And Terry's a savvy guy. He had rented it out as a location for a lot of high-end fashion shoots for Vogue and Harper's and that sort of thing, and music videos and episodics, but he'd never let anyone shoot a feature film there. Well, as we're walking around, we're talking about Watergate, and because we kind of both were with Pfeiffer, and I said, Terry, you know, this place looks like 1974. Now, it doesn't look like the Watergate Hotel because it's this little seaside motel, but I said, you know, it's 1974. And Terry said, well, look, if you can come up with a script, I'll let you shoot here for free, essentially. And cast and crew can stay here. They're closed in the winters. So, you know, we could all stay out there. And, you know, and the hardest thing for an indie film, if you're trying to do a period piece, is the location. But if you've got a great location that presents itself to you, that you really don't have to dress that much, that then you're like, you may as well shoot a period film. And then I teamed up with my friend Daniel Moya, who came on as my screenwriting partner. And then coincidentally, his aunt and uncle owned a period looking restaurant, a diner, that called the Front Street Station Diner, just like 20 minutes down the street from Terry's place. And we're like, oh my gosh, that's two locations. Now the film gods say you have to make a movie. So, and then we just had to kind of figure out a way to shoehorn this, you know, this East, you know, this tip of Long Island motel and diner into a Watergate story. So, of course, the first thing we did was we said, well, they're not in Long Island. They're in Maryland, you know, on the Chesapeake. And so that made it a little bit more closer proximity to D.C. And then we were able to come up with this, you know, construct this storyline about a young woman who's a transcriber in the Nixon White House who gets a hold of the missing 18 and a half minute gap, that tape, and then tries to leak it to a reporter, and they meet in the small town, and then they run afoul of hippie swingers and nefarious forces trying to get them. So obviously, you know, that's what we came up with. So it's historical fiction, but you know, we did a lot of research and it's a plausible speculative historical fiction for what it's worth.
Well, I love that. I love how the locations came first mm-hmm. before the rest of it. Now, you had, of course, had the idea, but when those locations clicked, you brought everything else together. And that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is recreating period is not easy because it's not just the locations that you want to get right. It's also the costumes, the hair, the props, the production design, all of that stuff. So to talk about the recreation of this period if you would, beyond the locations?
Sure. Well, I mean, we had a great team. Monica Dabrowski was our production designer. What's Sarah's last name? But she was our costume designer, who was amazing. She was sewing her own clothes because she collects old patterns. But those things don't cost much more. You know, it's they're choices that you make. You just have to be really careful about those choices. But then, you know, the mandate I said for everyone in every department, from the writer to post-production and everyone in between on set, was we're only going to use creative techniques that could have been used in 1974. So, you know, so that means there's no drone shots, you know, there's no Steadicam, because that was 1976, you know. So in terms of camera moves, in terms of the kinds of music that we used, how we recorded the music, this is all original music, and it's bossa nova influenced music, down to the vernacular of the dialogue and you know, and of course costumes, hair, makeup, the cars, you know, that are in the film, that kind of thing. So, but really having that main location was, you know, that's still 80% of the heavy lifting. That wow, helps sell the period, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I loved it. And I'll tell you what, we'll take a quick intermission. We're going to come back and I want to revisit that a little bit more, especially the way it was shot. I love that aspect of what you're talking about, the way you it, angles, and then utilizing the recordings within period as well. Love that. And that brings this to life in a way that feels so authentic. So we're going to take a quick intermission. We're going to come right back with Meet Me in the Movies right after this break.
Won't you come and meet me at the movies? Won't you come and watch a
Listen up. Do you have a passion for cooking? A desire to learn more about the craft of professional food preparation? If so, now's a great time to check out Cleveland Community College's brand new Culinary Arts Academy. This exciting 3-month program offers hands-on training for jobs in the food service industry. Across the nation, food service is one of the fastest growing industries. With your training at CCC's Culinary Arts Academy, you can compete for jobs in hotels, restaurants, conference centers, cruise ships, and other settings. Enroll in CCC's program and you'll gain in-depth training in food procedures, preparation, and commercial kitchen operations. Plus, the program includes a special add-on. You'll get your certificate in cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, training. You can earn good money, too. Depending on where you work, starting salaries range from $20,000 to $50,000. In just 12 weeks, you can be well on your way to gaining the know-how to handle food safely, properly, as a true professional. Now ask yourself, are you ready to start your journey today at CCC?
Won't you come and meet me at the movies? Won't you come and watch a
Hi, and welcome back to Meet Me the Movies. We are speaking with Dan Mirbish about 18 and a half. And Dan, on the other side of the break, we started to dig in a little bit into the actual technical filmmaking, and love to continue on that route. Something we see repeatedly throughout this film are these long unbroken takes and these extended sequences of dialogue without any cuts. So can you share a bit about, you know, the decisions you made as a filmmaker to structure the scenes in that fashion?
Well, one thing that was in the original screenplay when we were writing it, when Daniel and I were writing it, was that once you hear the tape playing the full 18 and a half minutes, which is, you know, spoiler alert, it's at the end of the movie, that we would be in a long, epic, unbroken shot. And we just kind of put that into the, you know, as a dare for ourselves as much as anything else. You know, as we got a little closer to shooting, we realized that would be, you know, challenging in all kinds of ways. And so we kind of came up with a rule that if the characters hit pause or stop on the player, then we could cut our take and go to traditional coverage. And then when they hit play again, then we're into these long oners. And we kind of realized, oh, this was, you know, this is going to work aesthetically. It's going to draw the audience in and make you listen and focus in the same way that our characters are. But also a big part of it is until you start working with the actors, you don't really know if it's going to work, because every combination of actors on every film you make is going to be a little bit different. They may have a terrific rhythm or chemistry and know all their lines, and you can hold a long oneer, as we say, you know, a long unbroken take for a long time. But then there's other pairs of or combinations of actors where it's just not going to work for all kinds of reasons, and that's okay. And you have to, as a director, you have to kind of accept and know that going in, and then be flexible about, well, when are you going to use it and when aren't you? And, you know, just because you had this idea in the script, you know, once you get on set and you realize, oh, there's a bumpy dolly track, or, you know, there's all kinds of technical and creative reasons why you can't always do that. We were very lucky in that with John Magaro and Willa Fitzgerald, we knew from the first day, which was the day that we shot this diner scene, which is very cut up. But I could tell from that first day that, oh, these actors are great, and they're great together. They have great chemistry together. In terms of their humor and their pacing and their style and their rhythm, and that we would then in subsequent scenes be able to do these long oneers with those two actors. Whereas there's another scene with an actress, Kathy Curtin, who was cast only about 36 hours before she showed up, who has like a 2-page monologue. And the first thing she says is, there's no way I'm going to memorize this long monologue. I just read the script today. And I said, that's okay, because for those scenes, we're going to shoot them in a completely different style. We're going to shoot them in this kind of a jump cutty style that is going to work for the scene, but it will also allow you to do something different. And actually, I want you to do something different in every take. And you don't have to read the same words. You don't have to memorize it exactly. You can do one take where we're shooting reaction shots of the other characters. You can just read the script. And so that then freed her up to not worry about it, not freak out about it, and just focus on the performance, which she gives a great performance. And stylistically, it's a difference from the other scenes that we were doing. So, but that's something, you know, as a director, you've just got to kind of be flexible and make the use the best style for the best team and the best actors that you have at that moment.
Back before the break, Dan, you talked about that location that was selected, yeah. the old motel that right. looked period. And I guess it did come in handy because you shot this during the pandemic. And so I'm sure that probably did help you out a little bit from a standpoint of keeping everybody there, possibly.
Well, yeah. So we started shooting March 3rd, 2020. What could possibly go wrong in March of 2020? And, you know, it was only a 15-day shoot, and we got 11 days in, and we found out that we were the last film shooting in North America. And that makes you wonder, what does everyone else know that you don't know? So we shut down, as was appropriate. And, you know, I live in LA, so I grabbed the hard drive, and this is it right here. That's the 18.5 hard drive right there. Grabbed that and got the first flight out of Islip back to LA, and just started editing the film and baking sourdough. But about a third of our crew, so about eight of the folks who were kind of the you know, Brooklyn hipster single types who didn't have families to go back to like me, they were afraid to go back to New York City, because if you remember at the beginning of the pandemic in the U.S., New York was the epicenter. So Terry, who owned the motel, very kindly said, well, look, no one else is at the hotel. Why don't you guys just stay here, you know, and you know, at least we're safe here in this little bubble before these things were called bubbles. And so about a third of the crew stayed there for about 10 weeks. And actually, our cinematographer, Elle Schneider, she stayed for 6 months. And wow. Then meanwhile, we, you know, I was back in L.A. Other people were in New York. They had their own little sort of artist in residence program. You know, they were shooting short films. They still had the camera too, so they could work on a lot of fun projects on their own there. And they were surviving on leftover product placement, Omaha steaks and coffee and things like that. But then a couple months into the pandemic, we realized, well, look, our actors are sitting at home not doing anything. They can't act in stage or screen or anything. So we recorded our missing 18 and a half minute gap with Bruce Campbell, John Cryer, and Ted Raimi. We were originally going to do that in post-production at some studio in LA. We'd fly them all in, but we realized they're all at home on Zoom. And they're just sitting around. And because the quality of the Nixon tapes aren't that good, we could do it on Zoom. You know, by this point, most of the actors had their own decent microphones. They were all used to, you know, recording things at home. And so, you know, in the middle of May, at the, you know, heart of the pandemic, we were able to do like this little 18 and a half minute radio play, essentially. Wow. Which was a real, you know, kick in the pants and exciting thing for us, you know, in this global despair that we were all going through, that we could still be creative. We could make a movie, we could act, we could direct, we could write. Meanwhile, my composer, Luis Guerra, was finding musicians around the world that could work remotely. So we wound up with a horn section in Mexico City and a singer in Brazil working out of a studio there. And again, working safely, but working creatively. And that was really exciting to everybody else on the production. Like, hey, even we are coming back because we're still working on this thing. And then sure enough, 6 months later, when the Screen Actors Guild and Directors Guild had the safe COVID safe protocols, masks and shields and testing and everything, we were able to come back and shoot those last 4 days safely. And we did.
Wow.
Yeah. It's one way to make a movie.
I love that story. I love it.
Yeah.
And as we mentioned at the top of this show, this film is getting a physical release. And as you can tell by the wall behind me with, you know, 1,000+ DVDs, we love physical media, love supporting it. And yeah, Dan, what you're holding right there is what it looks like. You have
it is. Here's the DVD.
Yeah, the feature film with also a wide range of special features. You have a 2-hour making of documentary.
Yeah,
you have a
if you're making up documentary isn't a half hour longer than the film, I think you failed. So yeah, so if you don't like the movie, stick around for the documentary. It's,
love it.
You know, yeah. It's like this interview, but longer and with pictures.
But yeah, just want to give you a chance to talk about the importance of having a physical release like that to you, and you know, keeping your work preserved and for people to access readily like that.
Yeah, no, it's really exciting. I was just giving a guest lecture at Indiana University a couple weeks ago, and I asked a class of about 40 undergrads, like, how many of you still or how many of you watch DVDs or collect DVDs? And about 80% of them raised their hand. And it's interesting that whereas it's a class of grad students, it's fewer. But physical media is coming back. And I think as people are realizing that, hey, you can watch something on, you know, on a streamer and it could be gone tomorrow. You could have paid for it and it's still gone tomorrow. You know, you could have an entire show on HBO Max and it could be gone. You could shoot a whole movie for Warner Brothers and it could be gone before it even comes out. You know, that's the way the industry's going. So, it just as people have been, as vinyl has made a huge comeback in, you know, for physical media for music in the last 5 years, which we put part of our soundtrack on vinyl as well. DVDs are and Blu-rays are, you know, really, I think, coming back, and people are appreciating, like, oh, it's not, you know, I mean, it's not just the fact that I can keep it and hold it, but also that it has all these extras. Because for whatever reason, when streaming got started, Netflix and Amazon, they said, nah, we're not going to do the bonus features. We're not going to do director's commentaries. We're not going to do behind the scenes. They could, like, technically, there's no reason why they couldn't have. And some are starting, Criterion Channel, I think, does have some of that. But not in the same way that DVDs and Blu-rays allow you to do. So we even have on here, there's an alternate audio track where you can watch the film as if you are at our world premiere at the Woodstock Film Festival. I literally recorded on this laptop, where they were laughing. So you can watch it essentially with a laugh track from the Woodstock Film Festival. Because honestly, at that point, that was in September of 21. There was like a little gap, a trough between the Delta and the Omicron variants where film festivals were live. And we didn't know if there was going to be another live film festival again. You know, we didn't know if people would ever go to theaters again at that point. It was still so much unknown. So I'm like, I'm going to capture an audience. And we'll stick it on the DVD. And we did. And so that's on there. There's a lot of fun bonus features. There's the full 18 and a half minute tape if people want to listen to that, with Bruce and Ted and John. There's a little bit with Lloyd Kaufman from Troma Films, who has a small cameo in the film, but he's at the at the Tallgrass Film Festival talking about the movie. But there's a lot of weird things that we come up with on the making of documentary, including the fact that Lloyd was at the Nixon White House at Trisha Nixon's wedding, like weird things like that. Bruce and Richard Kind talking about their memories of Watergate. These strange connections between our character, Connie, played by Willa Fitzgerald, and Cassidy Hutchinson. Right when the film was coming out for its theatrical release was right when Cassidy Hutchinson was giving her testimony at the January 6th committee. And there's like a lot of really strange parallels there that really make the film relevant and resonant to today's audiences. So there's a lot of fun things on there. And just the whole journey of making the film from screenplay to production to everything that happened with the pandemic, all the ups and downs there, but also then our whole festival journey and traveling around the world and getting the film on airlines and our Oscar campaign for best song for one of our songs, which went really well. So it's a fun journey. So if anyone's interested in films and filmmaking, you can really kind of see how it's done on a shoestring level, but still work with a really amazing cast and crew and have a really nice solid release with the film.
Yeah, Dan, I tell you, Thomas and I said this before we went on the air that we could probably talk to you for hours, and I will echo that. And I wish we could, but we are out of time.
Oh my
God. Love to have you back. Love to have you back sometime anytime on the show just to talk movies. Talk about your background. But before we wrap, I do want to give you a chance. Do you have any final thoughts about 18 and a half that you want to make sure you share with our audience before we say so long?
I'm on the Instagram, I think, at dmirvish, dmirvish. That's probably the easiest. And I was still, I guess, a little on Twitter, but it's not Twitter anymore. Anyway, Instagram seems to be most people's way of doing it. And check us out. And if you like the film, say something nice on Letterboxd or IMDb or Rotten Tomatoes. We're very honored. We were a certified fresh film. And it says certified fresh right there. And so a lot of critics like the film, but hopefully audiences do too. So thank you guys so much for having me on. And it's great to see all the Mannings all together again.
Dan Mirvish, thanks for joining us right here on Meet Me at the Movies. We appreciate it. The film is 18 and a half. It is available for home delivery. Check it out. For Thomas Manning and for the entire cast and crew right here on Meet Me at the Movies, we appreciate you spending time with us. And until next time, that is a wrap.
We'll tell about the happy and the sad ones. We'll talk about the good ones and the bad ones. Many films to view till we meet again.